Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the program. Chuck Morse, host of Chuck Morse Speaks here at Blog Talk Radio. My guest, who will be arriving shortly, is Ronald Rado. She's the author of A Commies, A Journey Through the Old Left, the New Left, and the Leftover Left. Ron is a co-author of The Rosenberg File, which was a definitive book on the that examined the infamous career of the Adam spies, the Rosenbergs, that being Julius and Ethel Rosenberg back in the late 1940s, early 1950s, and self-described red diaper baby. I thought we would talk a bit about his journey, if you will, and that's what the book is called, A Journey from the Far Left, which he grew up in. And he's a in some points in his life, he seemed to rub shoulders with all of the movers, or many of the movers and shakers, you know, on the American left, both in politics and in the culture. It's a personal memoir, and the thing that strikes me about this book in particular, and that I'd like to ask Ron about, what he observed with regard to the left-wing personality, if you will, how leftism affects a personality, what sort of people, what are their values, what is their moral compass, what are the characteristics, are they part of a cult, all of those sorts of general questions. And I don't want to give too much away here as we wait for Ron to call in. The issue really is, in a sense, of what I see as somewhat of to put it mildly, a skewed and rather warped moral compass. I mean, these are people who are or profess to be highly moral and view themselves, in a sense, in a projected sense. And when I say projection, I mean that in the Freudian sense, because they usually project this value upon their opponents, as people who are holier than thou, people who believe that they have some kind of a grasp on some sort of absolute truth, that they are the good people. They stand up for everything that is good. They oppose everything that is evil. There is this atmosphere, this whiff of high Dutch righteousness around them that they carry with them that I think affects their personalities. It's like every day they wake up and they descend from the mountain. You know, it's like Moses holding the Ten Commandments. I mean, and they often speak in their there are physical attributes that manifest this. And again, I know I'm generalizing here. There's a syrupy quality often in their voice, so that they speak, you know, down to the rest of us, like we're all somehow, you know, children that need their guidance. It's actually quite condescending. And with regard to erasers, it tends to be quite racist. But, I want to take a look at what sort of morality they actually do represent. You know, they claim to be holding up the interests of the little guy, the downtrodden. And by the way, many of them are well-meaning people in that they genuinely believe this. You know, they're not, I call them unconscious. They're not witting. But nevertheless, they've embraced this idea, and they hold fast to it. But the fact of the matter is that Ron Radosh brings up two examples in his book that I'd like to discuss with him with regard to how they have sense of moral rightness is actually quite skewed. And those examples are, first of all, the Rosenbergs themselves. These were radical communists. They were members of the Communist Party, not that that's relevant, because they could be or they couldn't be. The fact is they were, by any definition, radically on the left. And they were giving atomic secrets to the Soviet Union. Now, putting aside the utter evil of betraying their own country and placing the interests of Stalin over that of their own nation, and they did so, by the way, during the Hitler-Stalin Pact, which meant they were also placing the interests of Hitler and Stalin, over that of America and the Western democracies, 2 years of World War II. But they also, by giving atomic secrets, they're giving the Soviet Union the ability to create a nuclear bomb. I mean, hadn't we already seen the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Now, look, whether you think that the United States should have utilized that bomb or not, that's a very complicated question, and it's one that I think most Americans, including myself, have struggled with and have looked at both sides of it. But regardless of how you feel about that, was it humane? Was it proper to give the nuclear bomb to the Soviet Union and thus allow nuclear proliferation to begin? Because the Soviets obviously would help other communist countries get access to it, and in fact have. Today we have nuclear bombs with China, with North Korea, Pakistan, India. I mean, was this a good thing for humanity? Was this a good idea to possibly expose more millions of innocent people to a nuclear bomb and to radiation and the horrors of a nuclear, holocaust, not to mention the entire population of the planet? This is their idea of being humane. This is their idea of being good. Which, of course, brings me to the second point that Ron Radosh raises in his book, and that is when as a young man he knew Pete Seeger. Now, Pete Seeger was a left-wing, what Stalin or Lenin would have called a useful idiot. He sang folk songs that we thought would promote socialism and communism. And during the Hitler-Stalin Pact, when the Soviet line was to support Adolf Hitler, because that was their open alliance, he and his band, the Almanac Singers, recorded an album that was outright seditious. I mean, that was pro-communist, pro-Nazi position, the line. America they're part of the quote-unquote peace movement. And by peace, they meant keeping America out of the war so that the Soviets and the Nazis could gobble up Europe. That was what they meant by peace. Core socialism is relative. It's not, they don't actually believe fundamentally in peace like we do in the conventional sense. But during that war, the first 2 years of World War II, before the United States entered, they were railing against Roosevelt, calling him a capitalist roadster and a tool of the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds, and that he's the Morgans and whatnot, and that the British were imperialists and everything else. This is while Great Britain was being bombed almost daily by Nazis. And the French, of course, had already been occupied by the Nazis while the Soviets were occupying the Baltic states and declaring war in Finland. And this was at a time when World War II was fully underway. And Pete Seeger and his merry band of folk singers came out with this album in, I think it was March or April of 1941, during the height of the Hitler-Stalin Pact. Well, Hitler, of course, double-crossed his socialistic leftist partner, Stalin, on June 22, 1941, with a full-scale invasion of Russia called Operation Barbarossa. And at that point, of course, the Soviets took up the 180-degree turn and sent the message to the international left and all the stooges around the world that now suddenly they were no longer to be involved in a peace movement. Instead, they were to become super warlike, super hawks, super patriots to their respective nations, and they were to push their nations, shove their nations more into war because that's what was good for Mother Russia. And so immediately, Pete Seeger and his merry band of folk singers arranged to have the album suppressed. It doesn't exist anymore anywhere. I haven't been able to find it. They literally went out and they stopped the production. They bought up all the copies and they threw them out. Because now all of a sudden Pete Seeger puts on fatigues and he wants to fight for Roosevelt. And he sends a letter saying he's going to turn his banjo into a machine gun and go to war. Then, of course, right after the war, or as it became obvious that the Nazis were about to lose, the Soviet Union decided that it was time to shift again 180 degrees and once again become anti-American and once again start with the propaganda that America stood for the bourgeois capitalist interests and the corporations and all that good stuff. And they, with the Duclos letter, which was published in March of 1945, this was even before Hitler was dead, suddenly the left turned on the United States and became pro, you know, not pro-Hitler, but they became pro-Soviet and pro and anti-war. The United States should become isolationist. We should not interfere in the world. We were imperialists, in other words. And so this raises, of course, the broader question, as far as I'm concerned, which is, what exactly is this morality? What exactly is this high-sounding, ultra-moralistic, absolutist stance that leftists take and that they personify and they manifest literally in their mannerisms and in their approach to life? This insufferable sense of rightness, what exactly is that about? I mean, when I see people take that kind of insufferable stand, and that, by the way, includes conservatives, I mean, my suspicion goes up because human nature and human beings are not so perfect. You know, I mean, that's not the way the real world is. We may look in the conventional sense to the Torah, the Bible, and to its moral and ethical code as something to guide our lives, something to measure ourselves against. But none of us achieve that. Only God is perfect. We are imperfect beings. We're all sinners. That's what Christianity teaches, and I think it's right. And so we don't have this sense of haughtiness that we're absolutely right. We're humble. We have a sense of realism that we are potential sinners, and we have been sinners. Everyone is. Everyone has, you know, to varying degrees, and that we're repentant, and that we are, you know, we know that we're all going to end up equal, which is in the grave someday. We all are going to have to face our maker, whether you're a believer or not. And so, you know, there's a humbleness that is completely lacking in the leftist personality. And I think that goes to why they can do things like, during World War II, support Adolf Hitler and Stalin and actually engage in policies that would help Hitler and Stalin over the interests of their own country, and why they could support the Rosenbergs, who were involved with giving the nuclear bomb to Russia, for God's sakes. I mean, what could be more immoral than that? And yet they were so righteous and so smug, and that, you know, even to this day, I mean, Ron Radosh and his co-author, Joyce Milton, released this vigorously researched book. And they were figures on the left, by the way. They weren't conservatives. These are not right-wing writers or thinkers. They released the book in the 1980s. And even as far as then, the opposition and the hand-wringing and people who you'd think would be moralistic, they're twisting themselves into pretzels to not only defend the Rosenbergs, even though they couldn't really do that. So instead, they tried to destroy and smash the reputations of Ron Radosh and his co-author. And that's how they operate. It's not something, they cannot justify what they believe in. When you get down to actually saying, is this really something that you think is right? So instead, they try to turn the tables, and they try to attack their opponents, conservatives, Christians, people who believe in limited government, you know, normal people, if you will, frankly. And they try to do it by finding these little technical mistakes they might have made. I mean, they try to work them in a way that you know, we try to get them at any little chance they can to destroy their reputation, because they don't want to talk about the overall moral stand or lack of same. This phenomena where the subject has changed to the person who is raising the moral question rather than the moral question itself. which they will never answer. You know, we should note that after World War II, Germany, Nazi Germany, and the Nazism was repudiated by the world. There was the Nuremberg trials, which were imperfect because they didn't go after the Soviet Union. But nevertheless, they were able to expose, to a certain degree, the evils of Nazism. And it's something that is studied and understood by reasonable people and by reasonable nations. Not so with the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union, after the war, was able to continue to metastasize across the planet. You know, we should note that it was the Soviet Union that started World War II in partnership with the Nazis. They both started it by both equally invading Poland and divvying it up into two halves. But yet the Soviet Union was never held accountable. The Soviet Union was then rearmed, resupplied, and rebuilt by Westerners and by Western money indirectly, and by their Western agents, people like Harry Dexter White, who operated within the Roosevelt administration and who shipped over American scrip, American monetary plates and ink so that they could print money there, you know, using the American imprimatur, and other acts of treason. They were allowed to, they helped the Soviet Union get back on its feet. And thus the Soviet Union and communism was never held accountable, unlike Nazism, which rightfully was. So we'll always go down in history as never seeing the left or the far left actually being held accountable for their sin and for their evil. This is why they're able to continue to prance around self-righteously and quite morally, talk about their particular twisted faith, their political faith, and to do so without any accountability. And underneath it all, of course, is I think, the obvious trend on the part of what we might euphemistically call the Eastern Seaboard liberal establishment to support the communist movement, even after the fall of the Soviet Union. We never really got a look at or did a national example or an international study of the evils of communism, even as millions of people cried out who lived in slavery and suffering under that vicious but yet very perfect continuation of this personality, unabated, unrepentant, unaccountable, and you haven't continued to metastasize today. It's always going to be with us because communism is, as Whitaker Chambers, I think, identified in the introduction to his seminal book, Witness, the world's second oldest religion. It is, you know, the sin, it is the lure of the Garden of Eden. You know, whether you believe in the Torah literally or figuratively, that represents, the serpent represents the temptation for man to overthrow nature, overthrow God, overthrow the supernatural, and take physical possession of the world by knowing all things, by knowing all good and evil. That was the lure of the Garden of Eden. That was what the snake, the serpent, promised Eve if she partook of the forbidden fruit. And so every generation from that day till this day has this tendency. This isn't, you know, because if we had destroyed the Soviet Union earlier and there had been trials, that wouldn't have ended it. It would continue because it's part of human nature. I would suggest it's a dark part of human nature, and that is this element that seeks to forcibly transform us into something that we are not. You know, it seeks to, you know, I mean, the economic example is it seeks to redistribute our wealth. It seeks to make a, quote, level playing field when we're not all equal. We're born equal. Our souls are equal. We ought to strive. We'll all die equally. We're all equal under God because we all are created in the image of God. And we ought to have a system of freedom which protects de jure equality, the right to equal justice under the law. And that's an imperfect thing. because you do have people who get special favors because they're powerful. You do have people who might be more vulnerable because they're weaker. That's a given. That's the, unfortunately, the dark side of human nature that can never be abolished. But we can have, in a free society, in a reasonable society, an ongoing effort to try to counter that sort of corruption through freedom, through the ability to express ourselves. That's why the Founding Fathers recognized it as an inalienable right, the right to free speech, the right to free press, the right to free expression, the right to the free trade of goods and services inside the United States, the right to, you know, to dissent, the right to assemble. All of these things are there to be exercised by truly and genuinely enlightened citizens to try to ferret out corruption. That's why we have a system of justice that involves a separate judiciary that's not supposed to be influenced by politics, but that's supposed to be there to protect the American people in a natural balance of powers from the excesses not only of the other branches of government, but from corrupt practitioners in the private sector, crooks, criminals. So, you know, we have in place a system that tries to address the imperfectibility of man and does so in a way that tries to approximate a level of justice. But what, of course, the communists promise is what they euphemistically call the level playing field, which is that because there is inequality, and there is going to be inequality because we are unequal in our skill, in our ability, in circumstances of birth. You know, I mean, we're unequal because we were born in America versus being born in a very poor third world country. That's the way it is. There's nothing that can be done about that. So we can talk about things that could alleviate it, you know, in terms of creating more opportunity and removing barriers that prevent people from rising up. But ultimately, inequality is something that is just inherent. It's obvious in nature because we are different, where some of us are stronger and some of us are weaker in different areas. But the communist promise, the promise in the Garden of Eden, is that this elite, which are going to know these secrets and they're going to know how to transform humanity, are going to create absolute equality. And by doing so, the only way to do it is to take away the accomplishments of those who are more successful. And I mean that in the material sense particularly, because oftentimes communism, thanks to Marx, by the way, has reduced everything down to an economic theory and handed it over to those who are less successful. That's the theory. So this would somehow create equality. Logan, he told us very little about what the communist world would actually look like, but he did develop a slogan that is published toward the end of the Communist Manifesto, I believe, and that is, from each according to his ability to each according to his needs, as the ultimate virtue. What that means is that material, which he viewed as finite, would be distributed so that people who accomplish something would only get enough to live what they needed, and who determined that, of course, is not mentioned. And those who were needy, who were not accomplished for whatever reason, whether it be deliberate or accidental, they would get enough from those who had it so that they would not be needy. This is what would lead ultimately to Marx's vision of a world collectivist and colony, where ultimately governments would be abolished because they would have served their purpose, and mankind would move into this utopian state or this utopian condition that Marx called communism. And that condition would be something that by which a man would be collectivized, man would have given up any institution or any idea that divided him from others, and that would include private ownership of property, free trade in goods and services, faith in God, faith in religion, the nuclear family with a mother and a father and children, loyalties to groups, whether it be based upon faith or belief, and ultimately the abolition of the individual identity, that we would all be merged somehow, or as a progressive educator John Dewey called it, we would fuse. He talked about fusion into this huge, amorphous, international collectivist ant colony, this beehive, where everyone would just sort of exist as part of a machine that was completely and naturally coordinated with all of nature, and that we would no longer need these other things because we had become perfected. You know, I think that the Soviets or Marx or later communist theoreticians called this Homo Sovietica. Of course, the left-wing Nazis had a less radical view of it, cultic idea of an Übermensch, this elite, this select elite of supermen that would be ruling the world for benevolent reasons, that they would oversee the weaker people. You know, they would be supermen. They would be blonde-haired, blue-eyed, super strong, super tall. They would live to, you know, around 200 years old. And most importantly, they would have obtained a level of what the occult calls cosmic consciousness. They would become what this movement, I interviewed them on my cable show, they would become like the Maitreya. They would be saviors. They would be Christ figures on earth, supermen, godlike men and women, that would breed together to create a new species, the Übermensch, and that would be decide the absolute course of the rest of the world, so that the corrupted lesser species would either be gradually phased out or annihilated, or they would be compartmentalized and kept around to do you know, labor and to be used as needed, and would be completely and utterly controlled for their own benevolent good. Yeah, certainly Aldous Huxley talks about this in Brave New World, and George Orwell, you know, implies it in 1984 with his reference to control over the language and how things are determined. And in fact, this is the classic dictionary definition of socialism: public ownership of the means of production, public ownership of distribution, public ownership of communication, right? I mean, what is the public exactly? Is the state acting as an agent to create this transformation. And once the transformation is complete, then the so-called public, the state, as Marx said, withers away. And then you have the communist utopia, which of course is a world that's not only impossible, but it is a world that would be so evil and so despicable that it would be impossible for any of us to even imagine it. So anyway, it looks like Ron could not make it today, so we'll have to try another time. But his book is a good one, Commies, A Journey Through the Old Left, the New Left, and the Left on the Left. And while I have your attention, I should mention that my books are available on Amazon.com, Chuck Morse, M-O-R-S-E, like Morse code. You can check out my books. They're all reasonably priced, and there's reviews. You can look at the whole thing. And also my sponsor, which is myself, as an insurance agent in Massachusetts, I'm offering life insurance, both term and whole. And I'd love to talk with you about how to obtain it and why. And part of the deal is you get a podcast where I interview you and we talk about your life. So you can contact me at my phone number, 617-271-5044. I want to thank you all for listening this afternoon. This is Chuck Day, everybody.